All right, so Adam, give us your negative Nelly cold open then.
I don't want to be here.
Oh, wow. Well, that's,
is that any different from the other time?
Thank you, Don. Thank you. I thought it was just me for a while, but no, it's you, Adam. Hello and welcome to episode 205 of the Two Hosers Photo Show. My name is Alan in Tübingen, Germany, and with me as always is...
Adam, Vancouver.
And with us as sometimes is...
Don in Barrie, Ontario.
Don, great to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's been a while.
Has it? Because it feels like a couple of weeks, but it probably wasn't. It was probably the summer.
It was, yeah. It was before I got married and before travels around the world and to the Yukon and other places like that. And there's a lot has happened since I've been on last.
Yeah, but I don't think it's been that long. I think there's just no flies on you. I think you just keep moving.
Yeah, you know, it's been a crazy couple of months. I mean, September and October were, you know, traveling abroad. And then I came back and, you know, it's just been chaotic ever since because I had, I think you caught it actually, Alan, and I hope you did too, Adam. I was featured on an episode of The Nature of Things.
We watched it together.
Oh, fantastic.
Live in person.
In my living room.
In his living room, yeah.
It was pretty cool. It's called Chasing Snowflakes, and
what
so you can
is,
imagine where I might.
What is The Nature of Things?
The Nature of Things is a documentary produced by CBC, and it's hosted and narrated by David Suzuki, and they cover all, you know, a whole range of topics. Usually nature, conservancy, technology, that kind of stuff, psychological stuff. This one was focusing on winter weather, specifically snow. And so I open and close the episode with my work on snowflakes.
We call that bookending.
Bookending, yes. So it's kind of fun that I have the final word. I wish I had a bit more screen time on it, though. And I was talking to some of the other people that were profiled in there, and they echoed that sentiment. I really like the way that it came together. They filmed me twice last winter and put it into production for, I think it aired mid-November.
Yeah, we that was fantastic. I mean, for those of you who don't know, and that's most of the world really is. We've talked about it on the show, but it is a Canadian institution. Like it's been on the air probably forever.
Yeah, and you know what? This episode that I was on is the last one that's being produced in house at CBC.
Is that right?
Their entire documentary crew has been canned. They're outsourcing the production of this. I mean, it's probably going to be most of the same people working, but they're going to be working as contractors. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's the smart thing to do. CBC was one of the last people to do in-house documentaries like that. But you're right, it is an institution. It has been, I remember watching it when I was a kid. You know, it's been around for a very long time.
So at least 8 weeks.
Yeah. But you can watch it online, too. So maybe, Alan, I'll send you a link that you can put in the show notes if anybody wants to catch up and watch what we're talking about.
Don, we're one step ahead of you. We've already posted that. We'll post it again.
Oh, cool.
And we even told people how to circumvent the... what do you call it when it's blocked? The IP block.
The geolocation lock, whatever they call it.
Ooh, that's fancy.
Yeah, my computer makes frequent trips to the U.S., the U.K., and sometimes even into Finland to watch content that would normally be blocked by Canadians, for Canadians. So, yeah, it's I guess that is the way of things these days.
Right. Adam, are you doing that yet?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll talk after the show. I got a couple of those set up myself. And that way you can go ahead and access content like Don's episode anywhere in the world, which is fantastic. So I highly recommend checking that out. So what else you been up to, Don? You were in Bulgaria?
Yeah, so after me and my wife got married, our honeymoon was in Bulgaria. She's originally from there, so I think it's the third time that we've gone back. And we rented a car and drove across the entire country. Spent about a week doing that. And man, you could There are so many beautiful things to see there. There's two or three mountain ranges and a beautiful coastline. So, you know, photographically, there's a lot to admire, but it's so cheap. I mean, you can live like kings and queens on, you know, what it would cost for the cheapest, seediest motel here in Canada and and get the royal treatment. So, you know, we didn't spend a whole lot of money, but, you know, the experience was just absolutely breathtaking. You know, going up to the peaks of mountains and down into caves and all sorts. It's a beautiful country. So that was our honeymoon, quite the adventure. And came home for one day to do as much catch-up as I could before I hopped on a plane to go to the Yukon Wilderness for a second time.
Wow. That sounds like a lot of work, man.
Yeah, it has been. It's been nonstop. And so I was in the Yukon for about 3 weeks, I think. Just under
that
3 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. And
Wait. How long were you in Bulgaria for?
About 2 weeks.
Wow. So how did that go over with the wife?
Well, she knew I had to do it. It was the last opportunity that I would have to go up and travel with the group of hunters that I was with previously. Mm-hmm. And so basically all I have to do is pay for the airfare. And then I get the rest of the adventure kind of taken care of. And to be in the places that I'm able to get to with, you know, armed guards around me for, I mean, they're hunters, but I mean, they're intent on shooting anything that's dangerous. So, you know, there's a certain sense of safety and they're wonderful guys. And so, great northern light shots. I even got some snowflakes when I was up there too, but, the wildlife, the landscapes, the mountains, we traveled the road that we, you can almost call it a road, but the trail that we travel up, we'll lead all the way to the Northwest Territories, and so we traveled across the border into the NWT, and it's so freezing up there. I mean, it was September, but God, it's cold. It was fun. Photographically, it was it was paradise. You know, for the personal experience, it was a lot of hard work. You know, you're a part of a team at that camp. You have to be a cog in a machine really to make it all run. But it was work, and I came back and got some great images, and I think you might have seen some of them. But I haven't had a chance to even get through and edit them all yet. There's maybe 80% of them are still just waiting to be shown and shared.
Sounds great.
Now, what kind of gear do you travel with when you're doing such a thing?
Everything. I took my 1DX and my infrared modified 5D Mark II and my ultraviolet modified 5D Mark II, a 500mm f/4 lens, a whole assortment of other smaller lenses, three tripods, and as you can imagine, all this stuff weighs quite a bit, but we would set up a base camp and we would kind of leave everything there, and if we're going to be going out for a day, we would take whatever equipment was necessary. But a lot of the time I was shooting with that 500mm lens with a 2x teleconverter, so it was at 1,000mm.
Wow.
While I was hand-holding it from a moving boat. And so it was a challenge to get clear shots and to get the focus exactly where you want it to be, because at that effective aperture, you only have the central autofocus point that works, and it'll only work on the higher end cameras. And so, you have to get your subject dead center in focus, and then worry about maybe composition or framing as a secondary thing.
So why no tripod on the boat?
Well, I mean, if the engine or if the motor's running, then the vibration from that would cause the tripod to carry those vibrations through, and so it would be very difficult to get clear shots. But also, it's based on the angle that I have to maybe swing the camera around. Most of the photography is opportunistic for me. I mean, we're there to hunt, or at least they are, and I'm there as sort of a tag along. So I have to be extremely flexible, and I don't want the camera to end up in the water. And if the tripod is set up and the camera is mounted on that, then even just a tiny bump or something might destabilize that tripod. Or maybe if I swing around, I might knock it off by accident. Mm-hmm. And that's not a risk I was willing to take.
Absolutely. No, and plus on the boat, just with the swells and all that, it's very difficult to do on a tripod. You kind of need your feet, your legs to counteract the action of the boat.
Yeah, you kind of act as your own stabilizer.
Absolutely.
Sense.
I think we might have mentioned it on the show before, but the last, the third act of Jaws was effectively shot handheld. for that reason. It's all in the boat, out in the water, and that's that. Nothing you can do.
So. And Don, I got a question for Don. Don, as far as where's the intent of the images? Like all these images, obviously you probably shot a ton of, you know, wildlife stuff and landscapes, like you said. And then where are these images going to go? Is there a new book in the works, or is this just a personal portfolio? Sell some prints. Where are these going?
Well, I produced a book for the hunters for my first trip to the Yukon, and I'll make another private book for them that just kind of details the adventures. It's not meant for public viewing. It's just sort of the fun inside jokes and what have you. But right. The images, some of them have ended up in publications at this point. I think the next issue of Outdoor Photography Canada might feature a few of them. But when I do presentations to camera clubs or anything like that, these stories become fodder for those presentations. And so that keeps things nice and fresh. And I sell prints, and so they end up in a lot of different places. But I can't say specifically what the intent was when I was shooting them. I was just out there to add stuff to my portfolio, as most photographers would, and then you find a use for it afterwards.
Right.
And when you fly, like both to Bulgaria, for instance, you probably didn't bring as much photo equipment.
I brought the 1DX, and I didn't bring a telephoto lens, but I brought the 24-105 is one of my favorite lenses. The 24mm f1.4 is another great lens. I like to use that for landscape and low light stuff. I never really leave anywhere without my fisheye lens. That was kind of the trifecta of lenses that I brought with me.
So how do you pack that on the plane?
Well, I have a small sort of messenger bag, mm-hmm. and that becomes my carry-on. And so I just throw as much gear as I can into that. And I also had my infrared camera with me as well. So all this stuff kind of gets packed in there. And it's nondescript. It's not made for photographers. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't look like it's a camera bag. And that's important when you're traveling in those parts of the world, especially with the cost of the gear that's being concealed inside.
Right. My issue whenever I fly like back and forth from, say, Vancouver is, you know, it's a long flight. I don't really want to get on the plane the first instant I can. I'd like to kind of hang back a little bit. However, if you don't race onto the plane, you're not going to have any room in the carry-on above you.
This bag that I have, it actually, even when it's, you know, bulging full of stuff, it will fit under the seat in front of me. So I at least have that. And then I have a small tripod that I got. Actually, Manfrotto is one of my sponsors, and I had asked them, you know, do you have a nice, small, lightweight tripod that I could take with me? And they hooked me up with one of their Be-Free tripods, mm-hmm. and damn, that thing is great. And so much smaller and lighter than everything else that I had. And I took it to the Yukon, too.
Yeah, they're not one of our sponsors, but if you buy it on Amazon, you know what to do. Click through our site.
But those tripods I just throw in the overhead, and you know they could be anywhere. But I never leave my camera gear outside of sight. I wouldn't put it in the overhead unless I absolutely had to.
Really? See, I don't. I mean, I have no choice. Mine's a relatively large bag. I tend to. I'm okay with it in the overhead, but I don't like to have it, five, six seats away. And so it's becoming very, one of the things I get frustrated the most about flying is being able to keep my stuff near me. Because I don't have that much stuff. Like, relatively speaking, I only have my camera bag as a carry-on and my laptop. And so it's generally not that much stuff, but oftentimes there's just no room for it unless you race onto the plane.
Yeah. Well, I decided to ditch the laptop, and I got the Surface Pro 3, which was an absolutely wonderful little device. I was doing some great corporate work while I was away, and so I was able to pack everything and make it all small. Right, I was trying to get the footprint of gear as slim as possible, because I knew we'd be hiking and we'd be doing all sorts of stuff, and I'd be bringing it all with me. There was no sort of base of operations where I could leave things. So in that kind of a scenario, that's where I try to trim it down and make sure that I'm only carrying the necessities.
Great. Adam.
Yes.
T-shirts are very close, buddy.
Oh, I'm wearing mine right now. No joke.
As am I. Don's not, but he's gonna.
Awesome.
Don's getting one.
And I think I helped out with that, too, didn't I?
That's what I'm getting at. We hit a little snag. Just so everyone knows, I haven't been dragging my feet on this. I actually, there's a little bit of a snag that was hit in the production because the people we got to produce them originally we're not going with because they don't like they just do like a bulk. You have to order like 50 or 100 or whatever it is and then distribute them yourself, which Adam and I are not going to do. So we want sort of the storefront so our listeners all over the world can go in and just, buy it locally or buy it online and have them shipped locally without being exorbitant fees. That's the plan.
And fulfillment is such a pain. If you have to take in orders yourself and then package them up and ship them out. I mean, I'm doing that with my book right now.
Right.
And I've streamlined that process, but it wasn't easy at first.
Plus your book is all the same size.
It's all the same size, and I can prepackage them all into the same box and then just slap a shipping label on top that I can print out automatically, and away we go. Mm-hmm. But when you have maybe orders of different sized shirts or multiple items going together in the same thing, and then you have to worry about packaging and shipping, you're going to spend all your time just doing fulfillment.
Absolutely. And plus, on top of that, Adam and I, the genius businessmen that we are, we anticipate making zero money on these shirts.
Brilliant.
Well, yeah. That's how I'm gonna put my kid through college. But the idea is I mean, obviously there'll be a little bit, but the margins aren't very large because we want people to have these shirts. It's kind of a cool thing. There will be a little bit coming our way, but nothing to get excited about. We want to keep the cost low. And so, in order for us to do that, we're gonna go with this because there can be exorbitant shipping fees and there's sometimes duty and I don't wanna deal with all those tariffs and whatnot. So anyways, point being is now we've gone to this new place and which will be up soon, but they couldn't use our logo. They needed a vector graphic. And I don't even know what that means. I know what it means, but I don't do that. Adam, do you do that?
Don't know what that means.
There you go. And so I was kind of struggling with that, and then Don was nice enough to say, "Hey, I can help you out." So here you go.
So the wonders of Illustrator. It's actually a pretty easy process. There's a tool in Adobe Illustrator called Image Trace. Mm-hmm. And if you give it a high enough resolution file to deal with that has sort of straight edges like your logo would have, very clean lines, mm-hmm. It can translate that into mathematical vectors. Instead of having pixels, it now becomes a trace outline that is determined by an equation, basically.
So it's scalable.
It's entirely scalable. You could make it as big as a billboard, and you could nose up to it, and you wouldn't be able to see any pixels,
right.
Or as small as a business card. And so it's completely translatable to any size in any way, and I guess they required that, and a lot of people do, especially when logos are involved, because they want to give the best quality to it.
Well, it wasn't a requirement necessarily. I mean, it was suggested, and I could upload a regular file, like a JPEG or something like that, and they could make it happen. But it actually the quality of the print of the shirt wouldn't be as high, and actually the price of each individual shirt was considerably more. So in the effort to give us give the best quality and the lowest price, that's why the delay has happened. But I think we're through that, and we'll sort that out this week and have them up online ready to go.
You're welcome.
Much appreciated. And as I said to Don, I said, "Hey, thanks. I'll send you a shirt." And P.S. I was going to anyway. So.
Yeah, awesome. It all works out for us.
Yeah, you sort of misplayed that, I'll be honest. Yeah, so there you go. Did you shoot anything interesting this week? I'm going to go ahead and say that I did not. So, it's been 3 weeks, 4 weeks, hasn't it, Adam?
Yeah, it's been a while.
We haven't talked in a while.
Mass recorded.
We had no choice. Yeah, we went live. We had a photo challenge live during the show last week. 3 weeks ago or something like that when I was in Canada. And,
right.
So it's been that long. And so the only thing I shot that was interesting, I shot a photo of my son waiting for me at the airport, which isn't that interesting, but it meant a lot to me. So, there you go.
Great.
Adam.
I did. I haven't posted anything in a while. I just haven't gotten around to it. But I went to Vegas and took a few pictures there, but not so much on the Strip. We took rented a car and drove down to Red Rock Canyon, and I took a few pictures down in the canyon, and those were interesting. So that's my contribution. I will post them by the time this airs.
But listen, Adam, I saw some. Well, maybe we'll get into it with the photo challenge, but. Did you got the battery for your alien bees?
Yes, I did.
Okay,
yeah, we'll talk about that in the photo challenge because that was the photo challenge related chatter.
So we saved the best for last. Don, anything interesting this week?
Well, I've still been playing my catch up game to a lot of the stuff that had been piling up in the last little while. But it's winter now. I'm in the middle of my yearly snowflake project where I edit and post online a snowflake picture every day. And the conditions were perfect yesterday to get out and, you know, at ungodly hours to go and try and photograph some snowflakes.
Do you photograph one every day or you photograph a bunch and then...
Well, I mean, it's not going to be snowing every day. So, right. You know, yesterday I think I photographed about 10 of them. Some of them, like maybe 5, are worthy of going through the full editing process. And so, you know, there's 5 days worth. But it takes about 4 to 5 hours or so per image to combine them all together and, you know, do all the editing that's required for focus stacking and all that stuff. So, it takes me a lot of editing time per image. So if I could shoot one every day, I would, but it just doesn't happen that way. But in the last week, we have had some great opportunities for it.
And it's snowing there where you are.
Well, not right now, but the snow is covering the ground, yes.
That's what I meant. We've had none of the white stuff here. Adam, I know we got a little bit back in Vancouver.
Yeah, a little bit here.
Did it go away?
Yeah.
All right. You get any snowflake shots?
No.
No, I didn't think so. I just wanted to make it relevant.
But you have a book you can follow, and the process is laid out perfectly in there.
Yes. Yes. I will get around to it when the snow comes back.
But if
it does.
But if I end up reading the book, then the door in my bedroom is just going to keep slamming shut. So wait, did that get weird? I meant because it's acting as a doorstop is what I was getting at.
Hey,
and it got
Don,
weird.
Don, you'll appreciate this. My seven-year-old daughter, like we have, you know, a lot of books in our house. My wife is a bookie, so there's books everywhere. And amidst the literally hundreds, maybe 1,000 books in our house, the other day, my daughter on the sofa, no coaxing, had your book out and was flipping through it. So
that's fantastic.
There you go. 7.5-year-old, appropriate for children.
Well, I will take that endorsement and run with it. Thank you, Adam.
Yeah, so also suitable as a bedtime story. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, it'll put you to sleep.
Yes, it would.
This week's photo challenge, winter. Now, we didn't even know Don was going to be on the show, and this is kind of in his wheelhouse. But it was winter time, so hey, winter.
Right.
Who wants to go first?
Not
me. Alan, you go first.
Okay, let's get my shot out of the way. Okay, let's have a looking at... this is the winter here. We don't really have winter, is my point.
You're all dressed for it.
Huh? My kids?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, I'm just pulling it up. Yep, there we go. Here's my kids waiting for snow. The end.
How did you like this shot?
Quickly.
I can tell that.
Yeah.
I thought the challenge was strobe dark. Off the side, or if this is like the headlight of a car.
This is. Oh my God, we're going to podcast in 90 minutes, and I don't have a photo. So despite having 4 weeks lead time, winter didn't show here. I kept waiting and waiting for something wintry to show up, and we had nothing. We've had cold weather, but nothing that would say winter visually. And so right up until this last second, my kids were at gymnastics this afternoon, and they got home in the waning daylight. And I said, ran outside and grab the sled. We're going to go sit outside and get ready. So you know my son's sitting on a sled there?
Or, yep.
So that, I mean, if it was a better photo, you'd already know that. So I said, all right, let's go out and take some pictures right now. and take one picture that should read. And so I just grabbed the flash. I happened to have a flash set up, and I didn't even bother putting anything on it. I just ran out there, set it up there, and boom. Tried to make it interesting. That's all it was. It wasn't motivated at all. Don, you bring up a great point. What is that? Is it the moonlight? No. Someone's porch light? No. Headlight of a car? No, nothing. So it's just basically, I wanted to separate them from the background. That's it.
Well, mission accomplished, I suppose.
And yeah. I took exactly one photo. This was the only one I took. The end. So I kind of like where I was headed with this. And if I had... no, thematically...
Yeah,
and I think my son is actually at the point where he would cooperate now. My daughter, not so much. Even if you bribe her, she is really doing her best to sabotage everything, Dad. And so this was like no way this was going to happen. But I had a really good idea in my head of this vast open space and my son being upset and waiting for winter, even though he's never really seen winter.
What focal length did you use for this picture?
This was 50 mil.
Okay,
and.
The reason why I ask is I was just going to think that maybe if you got in closer with a wider angle lens, then you'd... Because I'm losing their expressions on their face, and maybe that's telling the story. Maybe that's the connection here to get that emotion of frustration that winter isn't here. But I can't really see it. It's too small.
No, you can't.
But I still want to have that vast landscape in behind. And I know portraiture is not typically done with wide-angle lenses, but I think that the story here might benefit from that.
I wholeheartedly agree, and that's what I said. I actually do like where I was headed, and I think I'll try this again with just my son because he'll cooperate. But maybe we'll try this again and do exactly what you just said. I like the vast open space. I even imagined it in black and white, and then it looked terrible in black and white. So I didn't do that. And the idea also being that you see the green grass and not the white snow.
Yeah.
So...
If it was black and white, it would be harder to tell that it wasn't snow. You'd have to look a little closer, I think.
Yeah, we don't want to ruin this photo.
Yeah, it's such a masterpiece.
Right. yeah, so there you go. So that was mine. Adam.
Yes.
All right, let's see the second place photo.
Let's see. Let's look at the setup shot, just because this is talking about the gear that I recently purchased.
So
the one
airplane?
Of my... Yeah, the one of the, my daughter and the airplane and the softbox and whatnot. So this is my new gear. Got a new Paul Buff softbox, which this is my first time pulling it out, and I absolutely love it. Love my smaller softbox that goes with a flash. This one is far bigger. I think it's 34 by 40 is the size of the softbox, but it's kind of really simple setup. It's sort of almost like an umbrella. It pops out and it mounts, has the right mounting plate for the Alien B strobe. They're made to go together, so it's super easy to put on. Pulled out the strobe and took it on location with the portable battery that I got, that Vagabond Mini, which absolutely love. Pretty awesome little setup. So had the studio strobe. I'm in the middle of the day. I kind of wanted to challenge it because, you know, this was probably 11:30 in the morning, sun blaring right in, and took my daughter to the shadow because I didn't want to have to try to completely balance the flash with the light in the 3 minutes that I was going to have to do this photo. So I put her in the shade and then just overpowered it so that I could balance the light between the bright background and foreground and the light coming from the strobe. So there's the setup shot. And then the photo that I chose to go with for winter is my kids kind of playing. So they were just messing around. They didn't want to cooperate with the photo. So I said, okay, this probably will make for a better photo anyways. And so they were playing around. I tried to just get them towards that shaded area, and then I used the softbox.
That's what we call photography judo. You just got to use their force against them.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So there you go. So I love the fact that the strobe, like, that's full power, and you saw the distance from the subject in the earlier photo, you know, whatever, 8 feet from the subject, maybe even less, 6 feet from the subject, just full blast to balance out that light.
Love it.
Don?
I like the setup shot with the airplane going through there. That's perfect timing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was kind of ticked off because I didn't see that coming, and then I was set up too far back because I would have liked to have zoomed in for the portrait, but it was already coming into frame. I was like, all right, well, I guess the setup shot will be kind of neat, and I took a portrait of this shot of my daughter, but minus the airplane, and I like this one better.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. I'll ask you the same question I asked Alan. What focal length did you shoot the portrait at?
That is 85 mil.
Cool. Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say that's kind of the go-to for any portrait. I just love that lens. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got a good depth to it. The only thing is you've got that sort of park bench off on the right-hand side, and there's some people back off in that distance as well. And so, usually I would say 85 is great. Sometimes a longer telephoto lens might remove some of those background distractions from the portraiture, as long as you can get the flash to still trigger remotely.
Yes. I agree wholeheartedly with your comment here, especially because I had to shoot this at I want to say F11, something like that. Mm-hmm. So again, middle of the day, this was not a good time to do it, but that was kind of the whole point was I wanted to test out the new gear in a more difficult time. Plus this was the time my kids were going to be playing outside in the snow. So just kind of the way it went. But I agree, if I had the 70 to 200 and I shot this at 200, then I probably could have, blurred the background a little bit more.
Or even just a different perspective. You wouldn't even include a lot of it as it is.
Yes.
Where's your ND filter?
My ND filter is, I actually looked for it, is somewhere in my massive photography trunk. And it was, again, one of those scenarios where it's like, okay, we're leaving now. Stop screwing around, Adam.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I know that very well. Don, you don't know that yet, I don't think, being married without the kids.
Well, I'm sure I will learn very quickly, soon as those opportunities arise. Well, I mean, soon enough. I mean, nothing has happened yet, although we're in the process of purchasing a house. And then after that, one thing will lead to another, I'm sure. I will.
First, Don's having kids, everybody.
Well, I plan to in the future, anyhow. but it's funny, though, because... my wife is so understanding when it comes to photography because, it's where I make my living. But there are limits to how understanding and patient people can be around a photographer, because we just take way too long to do things that everybody else would think is trivial. That's true in pretty much everything that I do with photography. A lot of my macro stuff is so meticulous and particular that other people would have given up ages before, but I stick with it, and I get the results, and it's worth it at the end. But it takes showing off the end result for people to even understand what the hell I was doing.
Absolutely. Yep. Real quick before I move on to Don's, how did you trigger the flash, Adam?
I have those 602C Yang Nuo triggers. So,
okay, so with a radio remote.
Yeah, radio remote, okay. Which is kind of awesome because, again, another use for those Yang Nuo triggers. If you needed a reason to buy them, this is another one.
That wasn't an ad, but you'd said before that these feature an optical trigger, which would go off your on-camera flash, would trigger the Paul Buff.
It will, in fact, do that. It would be more difficult for sure. Plus, I just don't want to get in the habit of using that because I think we talked about it last Christmas. It can create problems. Other people with cameras in the area, any flash going off, triggering yours. So this is just a much easier method, and you don't have to worry about anybody else screwing up your shot.
All right. Check out Don's photo here. Now, Don has, you can see the setup for Don's shot on the CBC Nature of Things.
Right.
That's they filmed you shooting something like this, correct?
Yeah, very similar. Exact same process. I think I've upgraded my ring flash since then, but I mean, it's the same gear. And it's a really simple idea where I have a black mitten and the snowflake falls on a black mitten and I photograph it. It gets more complicated than that, but those are the ingredients.
Have you thought of packaging black mittens with your book?
You know what? I have a couple of black mittens here for just that purpose, made by my grandmother.
Wow.
And so, yeah, they're very special.
It's like a signed Babe Ruth bat.
Exactly like a signed Babe Ruth bat. Yes, that's what I was going to say. Love the photo.
And this was, I think this was around 40 or 42 separate shots combined through focus stacking.
We've talked about this process before, so without going into great detail on that, I want to focus on the background a little bit.
Yeah.
It looks, is that in camera? Is that, did you cut this out and just add the background, you know, wholesale?
No, so in this case, the background behind the snowflake is the mitten that becomes out of focus. And so the out of focus background is just a bunch of black fibers, and some of them actually come through the focal plane, and I edit those ones out. So anywhere where an actual fiber has, even just like if it's out of focus but you can still see some lines there, I just clone out the hard edges on them. So that it just becomes sort of a soft, almost like a dark cloud kind of effect. Mm-hmm. But it's natural. That's the background that's there. I've just removed any of the distractions from it.
I love the background. The background, I mean, because if it was just 100% black, I think it would look phony.
Yeah, it would look fake. Yeah, it would look like it was pasted onto something or cut out of something.
Or even drawn in Illustrator, as if you decided, oh, I'm just going to draw this, you know, from scratch, like, you know, the movie Frozen or something like that. Whereas this, you know, it looks legit.
And there's, well, especially when you're looking at a real snowflake versus something maybe from Frozen or anything that's, you know, a cartoon drawing, they're not symmetrical. There's some balance and equality to it, but there's no real symmetry when it comes to these big snowflakes. This is one of the biggest that I think I photographed at around, I think it's about 7.5 millimeters. The biggest ones get to about a centimeter or so.
Okay.
And so this, if you have a regular macro lens and a crop sensor, it would fill maybe about a quarter of the frame. And so if you want to get any closer, then you'd have to use either close-up filters on the front or extension tubes on the back of the lens to increase your magnification. So you need to get close for these subjects.
Now, how many people are doing this?
Well, you know, to the degree that I am, not many. There's a physicist at Caltech in California that studies crystal formations and grows snowflakes in a lab. There's a guy in Russia that does a lot of experiments with it. But as a hobby to experiment and play with, there's I'm going to guess hundreds. I mean, I wrote all the process through in the book, so anybody can pick it up and try it. And it's a lot of fun. To the degree that I do it, well, probably very few. I could count them on one hand.
Yeah, I know pretty much everything there is to know, and I only know of you. So, good for you.
Okay. Well, I found a niche, and I've climbed that vertical.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That's great. Well, no, obviously, I definitely finished third this week.
Well, I want to add a little story to this particular image because I discovered something about the new flash that I had bought. I upgraded to the Canon. They released a new ring flash earlier this year, the MR14EX version 2. And they had said specifically in, you know, on all the documentation that it had a faster flash recycling. And it actually has a really cool feature that that I like. Through a custom function, if I double half press the shutter button, I can turn on the focus lamps on the ring flash so that I can see my subject without actually taking my eye away from the viewfinder and finding the button on the flash itself to do it. So I bought this this new flash for that, and it works great. But
so it's like a modeling light?
Not exactly, because the modeling light would replicate the exact lighting angles of the flash itself. So these ones are focusing lamps. They just provide a light source for you to find where the focus should be.
Gotcha.
Because when you're hunkering down over top of a subject, you're usually very close and you're blocking out the ambient light, and it's difficult to see through the viewfinder. It's very easy for me to turn that feature on, but after I was shooting for a while, maybe I would get one or two snowflakes in the bag, and then I'd try to keep going, and the flash would just time out. Like, well, it would just stop working. And it turns out that it was hitting its temperature safety limit, because after firing off repeated flashes, in quick succession, firing off hundreds of flashes, it decides it's not going to work anymore. It's just going to stop working, period. And I looked into this because I didn't have this problem with my first flash. And it's it's not actually based on temperature. It's based on the number of exposures. And when I'm in sub-zero temps outside, I'm not worried about the flash head overheating.
Right.
It's just it's not going to be an issue. And so I looked around. There's no way to deactivate or circumvent the safety feature through an official way. But I realized that it wasn't based on actual temperatures. It was based on just an internal counter. So I figured out that if I remove the battery cover and then put the battery cover back on, it resets the counter. And so that's how I can circumvent the safety features of the flash to keep shooting in the cold.
I love it when you have to outthink the engineers.
But to that point, though, I mean, I was thinking, Adam had just mentioned the Young Nuo triggers. Young Nuo makes a very good ring flash from what I've heard. A lot of people commenting quite positively on it. It's only like $100, $125 bucks. And so I've added that to my Christmas wish list. And hopefully something will come in and help me out, which I'm trying to give you a nice segue to the next thing.
Let's get right into it. Christmas wish list this year, Adam.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure you're still awake.
Yes.
Okay. Christmas is coming. Three weeks away?
Yes.
I'll ask your kids. Your kids will know exactly down to the day. In fact, today, you know what today is here in Germany?
No.
Nikolausabend, which means tomorrow, Nicholas comes to the house tomorrow on December the 6th.
Yes.
Yeah, you leave your boots out and he fills them full of chocolate and whatnot.
Great.
That's tomorrow. Christmas is upon us, and that means let's figure out what it is we want for Christmas. And I don't think what we want, but what we would suggest that people should want for Christmas. So do you have any suggestions, Adam? We'll start small.
I thought of a couple of ideas in the sort of $50 to $60 range.
Okay.
So some of the things that I really like, camera strap. So, you know, a dedicated camera strap that, can go across your shoulder and sort of so the camera lays by your side. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of different options available, but you can spend anywhere between, $30 and $40 up to easily $100, depending on the bells and whistles. So that's one thing I love at the low end price range. So do you want to pass it around or do you want me to give you a couple?
I want to hear what Don has to say about camera straps. What do you use for a camera strap?
I actually don't use a traditional camera strap. I simply use a hand strap. And so there's nothing that would go around my neck or that would fasten the camera tightly. But the hand strap just gives me a better grip on it. And when I'm walking around, I don't have it tied around my neck. And when I'm not using the strap, it's not getting in the way of things. So just the simple hand strap is all I need. And thankfully, I've never dropped my camera. If I had, I'd probably rethink the idea. But
which hand strap do you use?
Canon, I don't think they make this one anymore.
Which
it was their
the problem I'm running into, yes.
It was their E1 hand strap, mm-hmm. Which you might still be able to find online on eBay or something like that. It was a real pain to get it, threaded through the camera properly. It doesn't come with instructions, and it most certainly requires them. But when you've got it all set up, it's good and snug, and it makes a nice fit. They've come up with a newer version of this that I think is a bit more universal, but I don't like it as much. I've tried both, and I prefer the older design.
Well, I need to get one. I don't know if I'm going to find it on eBay in Germany. Maybe. Possibly. I mean, I guess they do ship. I need the pistol, sort of the pistol grip. It's not really called a pistol grip, is it? But it's not like a hand strap, like a point-and-shoot camera that you kind of twirl around your wrist.
No, it's got like a nice thick pad on the outside of your hand that really keeps your hand snug into the camera. And you can adjust the tightness of that. But so like when I'm walking around, I can hold my camera down on my side with my hand, and it's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to fall off of my grip.
Yes, I would like one for video, like very specifically to use with shooting video, and I haven't been able to find one. So
Here's one consideration for people when they're trying to decide whether to get, some sort of strap like you guys are describing or the over-the-shoulder. Where I feel like I need the over-the-shoulder is if I'm doing lots of messing around with off-camera lights. So I need to have both my hands free, and I don't want to be constantly putting my camera somewhere else and picking it up, especially if I'm outside. So the strap is awesome because it hangs by my side, and then I can do what I need to do with setting up lighting. So that's kind of a consideration. If you're not doing that, then they're really, you know, I don't see any reason why you'd need to have the over the shoulder.
And again, with the kids come in, if you have to deal with your kids changing diapers, stuff like that, you're going to want to have a over the shoulder strap.
Right. Yeah.
Don, what is your suggestion for the small, on the small end of Christmas gift?
Around $20, I think, was the price range that I came up with. And, you know, every photographer, I do a lot of close-up stuff, but every photographer should explore this because it's a lot of fun. It's easy to do, and there's just a fascinating world in your own backyard. And so I would think that getting a set of close-up filters would be a great stocking stuffer or something for a photographer to have wrapped under the tree. I bought a set of 77mm filters. Usually, you know, the bigger filters are more expensive, but again, cheap on eBay, and I'm sure you'd have time to get it before Christmas. But four filters, each have different magnifications, and you can actually stack them up together to increase the magnification. The quality is not going to be fantastic, but it opens up an entirely new realm of photography for about $20, and they're just really fun to play around with.
So it's kind of a poor man's macro.
It is. Well, I mean, a regular macro lens would cost into the hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. But you could put these on top of any lens. They function with the same optical principle as reading glasses do. They just let you focus closer. And so you can get the camera closer to the subject, nice and sharp. The edges of the frame will typically fall off and get blurry. But in macro photography, you're usually dealing with that anyhow.
Great. My suggestion, I went even smaller price-wise. Get a lens pen. That's what I think you should have in your bag. Like the little lens brush on the one end and the little chamois on the other to keep your lens clean.
Good advice.
I used to have one. Can't find it.
So Adam, hint, hint.
Yeah. Adam, if you're going to ship something over, go with the lens pen.
Yeah, the shipping on that would be more than the actual pen, I think.
Well, you can get it on Amazon.de for free. So anyways, what I'm just saying. Just saying. That's how you do it.
Okay. All right.
Ship it from your house. Come on.
I'll keep it in mind. Well, I thought you just wanted one of mine.
Oh, do you have them?
Yeah. I've got a couple.
Is one of them mine?
No.
Did I leave it at your house?
And why do you have a couple of them?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's one of those things that I like to have. Like, I have two different camera bags. I like to just keep one in each because I never know when I'm going to use it. And it's one of those things that I don't want to be transferring it back and forth between camera bags. So, yeah. They're anywhere between $10 and $15. So I feel like it's one of those things that I can afford to have two of.
And probably afford to buy me one because I think sounds like one of them is mine anyway.
No, neither of them are yours.
Sounds all dodgy. Adam, middle, you have more small ones?
I put in there, I also had filter. So this time of year, I said an ND filter or a variable neutral density filter just because it's getting dark so much earlier. So, you know, if people are interested in experimenting with some long exposure stuff, then like Don said, pretty inexpensive to go out and get yourself a filter. If you're going to, you know, buy a B&W one, then you're going to spend a lot more money. But there's lots of cheap ND filters that you can get out there for, you know, $20 or $30 that will let you experiment with long exposure. And then I also threw in there GorillaPod, just another item around $50 that's super versatile. And if you don't want to pack around a full-size tripod, it lets you do the run-in that we talk about so much. And or just, you know, anchor a light somewhere that you don't have a tripod or you don't have a light stand, you can anchor your light somewhere that otherwise would be impossible.
Okay, so something in the medium range now. We didn't set any actual price limits, but Don, what do you got for the medium?
Well, you know, I was thinking every photographer should have access to great editing tools, and the Creative Cloud, if a photographer doesn't have it now, I mean, it's $10 a month, that's like $120 for a year, and if I could consider that sort of a medium price range as far as photographic equipment is concerned, it's still probably on the lower end. But I'd encourage if you know that the photographer in your life, whether it's you or it's somebody else, doesn't have access to Photoshop and Lightroom and all these great tools, they've never been cheaper. And you know, what better time than over the holidays when you've got some free time to dig in and start to learn how to use it?
That's a great one. I mean, I've heard a lot of people talking negatively about the whole concept of the Adobe's Creative Cloud.
But if you want to, like in the past model, if you wanted the full version of Photoshop with all the bells and whistles, you'd be looking at $1,000 retail price.
And that's actually on the low end, because back in the old days, and what was considered full-featured wasn't that full-featured. I think it was around $1,500 plus, in Canada anyways, I think. I get confused because I've bought Final Cut Pro, for example, early on, version 1, for around $1,500. And I've bought it since. And so if you add up all the money you spend on something like that, it is very expensive. So $120 a year really isn't that expensive. And I'm guessing they keep it pretty up to date.
Yeah, and so they're updating it at least quarterly with major updates. But of course, when new cameras come out, they're always keeping it up to date. Well, one of the issues where people would have in the past is, let's say you've got a version of Photoshop, say Photoshop CS3 or CS4, and then you run out and you buy a new camera after the next version of Photoshop has come out. Well, your software is not going to be updated to recognize the raw files from your new camera. You'll need to go out and buy a new version of Photoshop in order to read the raw files properly. And so now you never have that problem anymore. You're always up to date. You're always sort of riding the edge of all the new features and having all the latest compatibility. And so why not?
Great. My medium suggestion is ask for frames. If you know a photographer, buy him some picture frames, because odds are nowadays, just the way things have kind of shifted, is most everything happens online, and that's a shame. I like books. I like seeing prints, and this gives the photographer the opportunity to show them off in the house and get actual physical prints done and decorate in the house. So that's my suggestion there.
That's great, and actually that in some way steals my thunder for my expensive pick, but
expensive we'll save frames.
Well, I don't want to jump ahead, but I completely agree with you. I think that everything is done online, and so many times, you know, you'll walk into somebody's house, you know that they're a photographer to some degree, but you don't see their artwork hanging or displayed anywhere.
Absolutely. Adam has gone the other way, and I mean that with a complete compliment, not like it sounds like a rip. It's not. Adam has a lot of photos up, and I appreciate that every time I go over there, because he's taken about 99% of them.
Yeah, there's one you took that's up.
There's three or four.
Oh, is there that many? I didn't realize.
Well,
that.
You didn't take your own wedding photos, man.
That's true. That's true. No wedding
photos. But the one I took, the one that is, you had one of the canvas wraps done. That was prior to us starting the show. So that's something that, I mean, it wouldn't have been easy to do because you're in a group photo. But that's something that you could very much handle on your own now. You wouldn't need me, except for that being in it with all those kids might be kind of a hassle.
Right.
But yeah, absolutely. I love having... We always have extra picture frames kicking around the house. They make great gifts. If you're stuck, you're going to someone's house warming or something like that, it's really simple to go get a print made and pop it in a reasonably cheap frame. And there you go. That's your gift. So, Adam.
For medium, I put the remote triggers, because for anywhere between $120 to $150, depending on where you're at in the world, you can buy a set of two. You need they're all transceivers now, but you need one to go on top of your camera to trigger whatever light you're going to use off camera. And in the world of portrait photography, if that's your thing, we talk a lot about it. It completely changes the game in terms of what you're able to do. So, not expensive. If you already own a flash, to me, it's a no-brainer. Get the flash off the camera and start experimenting.
Absolutely. If you own a flash and don't own triggers yet, you're doing it wrong.
Agreed.
Although, Don, you don't do that much off-camera flash, do you?
Well, I do, but I don't like the, if I'm doing off-camera flash, it's going to be like just my. I've got a 580 Canon speedlight, and I've got a cord for it because when I'm doing my macro work, it doesn't need to be far away. It just needs to be angled more closely to the front of the lens than on the top of the camera. And so, while I completely agree with you. Triggers are great, especially if you're doing anything on a larger scale. For me, I guess I can get away with it with just a cord.
Right. I actually have a cord as well, and that's very handy to have. Just whip out and really quickly have ETTL at your hands, and they're, you know, you can get cheap versions for like $15 now that work almost some of the time. And
I made the stupid mistake and I bought the official Canon branded one, which I guess, I mean, it does claim to be weather sealed and all of that, but it costs like $130.
Okay, listen, now, does it fire every time?
Yes, it does.
Does it work on ETTL every time?
Yes, it does.
Money well spent.
I suppose so. But I'm sure I could find something that hits those same talking points for half the price or less.
Possibly half. If you go any lower than that, like I did, I got the $15 one, and it's sitting right next to your book holding my door open. So let's go to the large. Now, here's where we can go on a big scale. Don, what do you got for a large?
Well, it's almost the same as what you had picked for your medium, but kicking it up a notch because, you know, as you had mentioned, you know, photos that we have online are rarely ever printed, but I tend to crop creatively. Like, I don't fit it into any pre-described dimensions of, say, a 4x6 or maybe square or whatever. If things should be slightly off because the composition is, you know, it benefits from that, then, you know, crop your image to give you the best results. And don't worry about any preconceived ratios for, you know, printing things, because the world is sort of online when we're dealing with most of our image sharing and viewership. But if you want to then take that great image and put it on your wall, you can't go out to the local store, the craft store or wherever, and buy a frame, because it's not going to fit perfectly. And if you want to get something big, and I encourage photographers, of course, make that big print, you know, behind the living room couch and what have you. So I was going to say, every image is going to be slightly different, but, you know, go in and talk to your local framer and get a gift certificate or a gift card with as much as you can afford, really, to put onto that for that person. Custom framing is not cheap. I mean, the most expensive custom frame I've had done was around $500 or $600. But, I mean, this is for a big, like, 80-inch by 20-inch thing. And so, you know, keeping that in mind, if you want to have a really, really nice presentation of your work, you might not be able to just go and buy a frame, but most photographers are not going to invest in doing that unless they have a push, unless they have an incentive. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, setting them up with that incentive, you know, $200, $300 towards framing costs, they might even be able to completely cover the cost of a really good framing job and have their work properly displayed on their walls.
Why should I spend $500 when I see that you can get, you know, frames at IKEA for $40? Big ones.
Yeah, well, and so there's a few things to keep in mind. The quality of the glass is important, and so there's two or three different grades of glass. The more expensive ones that they call like museum grade, they'll actually have the multi-coatings that they have on filters. So they remove glare and reflections and things like that from the surface of the glass itself. But they'll also block UV light. And if they block the UV light, then the print underneath will last a lot longer. They're archival. So the glass is important. But oftentimes when you're doing the framing, you can have special mats cut and multiple layers of mats that add some nice accents around the image. It's not just the image itself. The entire presentation includes the frame. And oftentimes it's going to be, you know, custom decisions based on the colors and the context of the image that's being presented. And you're not going to get that from IKEA. Absolutely. The IKEA frame might look nice, but it's sort of a general all-purpose thing. And you can tell that it's just a cheap IKEA frame when you look at it.
Absolutely. Now, I've had custom framing done in the past as well, and with the mats. And I think the biggest sort of shock is when you go to get mat work done, and you think, wow, it's that much just for that little mat?
No, but when you see it done, and you see it done right, it mm-hmm. makes a world of difference.
Absolutely.
You can't even compare.
No, absolutely. And so I do highly recommend getting the custom framing done for something that you really like and really want to show off. Adam.
Yes.
Large. What's your go big?
This kind of an obvious one, but, you know, new lens. So I think everybody who's probably listening to our podcast doesn't have the complete kit of everything that they probably want in terms of glass. So, new lens. So for those that don't have one, we're getting more and more emails from people just saying, you know, that they have the 85-1.8 lens and they've upgraded to full frame cameras and they're loving that. So whether you're on a crop or particularly if you've recently made the jump to full frame, 85 millimeter for portrait photography is such a small form factor, pretty reasonable cost. We're talking about, you know, most places around $400 or less, and just such a versatile lens.
We talked about a couple episodes ago on return on investment. This is one of those places that you get a great return on the 85 mil lens. Adam and I never stopped talking about how much we love those lenses for shooting people.
I rented the 85 f1.2 that Canon makes when I was attending my stepsister's wedding earlier this year, and it is just a gorgeous piece of equipment. And well, any 85 millimeter focal length lens will be, but you get just a certain look and feel that I can't get with any other piece of equipment in my kit.
Right. So, and then that lens retails for $2,000?
Something like that. Yeah, it's not cheap. I mean, they make an f1.8 version as well, and so you'll get a very similar experience to that, and that's I think that's below $1,000.
The f1.8, that's what Adam and I both have, and those are around $400.
Yeah, that's the one we've got. So good bang for your buck.
Yeah, so you can go and get the 1.2 and put a, you know, $20 UV filter on it to protect it.
Or, yeah, there's your stocking stuffer.
Yeah, just go ahead and do that, or get the 1.8 and go crazy with it. And it stays on my camera pretty much all the time. It's well, one of my cameras. I have multiple cameras, but it's my go-to lens.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting too, Alan? I hate UV filters, and I'm sorry to go off on a tangent here, but I bought a camera that's modified specifically for ultraviolet photography, and I haven't used it to any great degree yet. I want to, you know, photograph some flowers and reveal the patterns that are hidden in there. But I was just curious because if I have a camera that only shoots in ultraviolet, what happens if I hold up a UV filter that's supposed to block the UV light? Uh-huh. It doesn't actually block it. I've tried 3 or 4 different UV filters that claim to block ultraviolet light, and it all passes straight on through because that camera will pick it up.
Yeah, but still.
So not only are they useless, they're useless.
They are, yeah. Absolutely. No, they're not useless. Now, I this is where I'll step in and say they work great as a clear glass. If you want to throw it on there and then smudge a little Vaseline around it, like you get a nice effect for portraits.
Oh, sure. But, you know, and also if you've got weather sealing on your lens, if you read the manual, they say that you need to have a filter on the lens for the weather sealing to be complete. And so, yeah, there are some uses for it.
Yeah. Also, if your margins on cameras are like almost zero and you want to pay for your new Maserati, then you have to sell filters.
Exactly. Oh, I've done that for too many years.
Absolutely. Well, that's how you got your Maserati.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, my large one is actually physically large and cost-wise very, very, very reasonably priced. Probably under $100. I wouldn't recommend spending less than that, but go get yourself a background stand. The backdrop one that you have, Adam?
Yeah.
Basically two large tripods with a bar in the middle. Go pick one up. If you shoot people, it is wildly handy. It's one of those things I've put off and put off for so long. I think, I can always find a white wall. Because, heck, you know, you're in Germany, every interior wall is white. And so you can always go ahead and create a white background. But having that seamless white background just ready to go whenever you need it, no matter where you are, wildly handy. And so I've recently picked one up myself. I haven't had much chance to use it, but what little I have, I just can't say enough about it. Under $100, I think. Now, you can spend more, and you can spend way less. I think I saw some for around like $30, but I know better than that. Don't buy those ones.
Yeah, it's kind of comes down to, the sturdiness of the light stands that sort of anchor it. And I can tell you from experience, because I've had mine for a few years and do lots of shooting children with it. And as they run on and off the paper, if the light stands are not sturdy, mm-hmm. The whole thing is coming crashing down and possibly through a window. So, yeah, I would recommend spending the $100.
Yeah. Probably don't need them for snowflakes, though.
Probably not.
Go with a mitten in that case. That's what I would do. And get some new mittens. So that's it. That's what you should wish for. Now, I thought this year we'd say, what's one thing that you'd like to give somebody as a photographer to give a somebody else for a gift? Adam, do you have anything in mind?
We always make a yearly calendar. So that's, I take, you know, a picture from each month. I kind of go through my list of the previous year, and we make a calendar, mostly of pictures of the kids that we give to relatives. Generally my parents, my wife's parents, relatives, things like that. So that's my yearly photo gift.
And it lasts the whole year.
There you go. And then they're actually looking forward to the one for the next year. So
do you shoot monthly themed photos?
No, I do not.
Will you this year?
Probably not. Never have in the past, but I usually, when I go back and look through each month looking for the photo, I usually like to pick something that says July or says August, you know, in terms of the context.
So then yes, the answer to my question was yes, you do.
But I shoot those photos anyways. That wasn't the intention when I took the photo.
Right. Yeah. Okay. No, that's what I meant. It's like you don't put a snowy picture in May.
No, do not. Yeah.
Don, what can you recommend that you would give to somebody else?
Well, I mean, to, you know, close family and things like that, putting together a photo book can be a wonderful gift. And I think that there's still quite a bit of time to get that done before Christmas, just to get the images and maybe some stories along with it. You know, making photographic prints for an album never really happens these days. But if you can get like a book through Blurb, which, you know, if you're getting that Creative Cloud subscription, you can do that right through Lightroom. And so I did, when was it? It was earlier in the summer. I did a photo book through Lightroom and just printed up a couple of copies and gave them away as gifts. And it was just incredibly well received. And it's something that, you know, people will keep for quite a long time. And I think both of you have made photo books like this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, well, I mean, it's a keepsake. It's something that, you know, it's far more memorable than a pair of socks or, you know, an ugly sweater. I think anything that a photographer that they can give that involves their art in some way is going to be a well-received gift. So whether it's a calendar or a book or whatever the heck Alan's going to come up with, I think that you're, you know, you use your skills appropriately with your gift-giving ideas, and you'll have success no matter what you find.
Going to say before you jump in, and never discount that as a marketing tool, because I mean, no, I'm serious. I'm 100% serious, because someone who you gave that to shows it to somebody else and they say, you know, who took that photo? And the next thing you know, they're emailing you asking you to do something for them. So I've had that experience multiple times just off something as simple as a photo book or a calendar. So, you know, it's sometimes it's not that that's your intent when you give it, just that it is another marketing tool. So you want to include your best images, of course.
Absolutely. Actually, my wife and I every year for each of our kids make an album. We do the old school album though, and I'm wondering if we'll actually move on to the books. I mean, I've had books printed for other things, but for this, I don't know if we'll move on or not. But there's something about it. I like the old albums. I don't know if it's just the massive amount of work that I like, but no, it's in spite of that. But no, my gift to somebody else, and I've done this already for a birthday, is give somebody a lesson. Somebody you probably have an aspiring photographer in you know, your family or your close circle of friends. I wouldn't do this for, you know, for anyone who wasn't a close friend, but because it's quite a big commitment to take, you know, maybe take 2 or 3 hours and go out and do a little sort of one-on-one photo workshop with somebody and give them some, you know, pointers on how to get going in the right direction photographically.
That's a fantastic idea.
And then give them a book with your name on it. So I have done that earlier this year when I was still in Canada in the summer, and it was well received. In fact, my suggestion, if you do that, actually see if you can get a couple of people to come out. Not just one, you know, one-on-one. If you can go one-on-two, one-on-three, something like that, not only does, obviously, you know, you spread your gift wider, but it gives the people learning sort of, you know, other people to bounce ideas off of, and afterwards they can kind of ask each other, hey, what did you, you know, what did you get about, you know, the aperture stuff and depth of field, and what did he say about the depth of field, and that sort of, they tend to build on their on the knowledge they learn when they talk to each other. That's it. That's Christmas.
Yeah.
Great.
There we go.
Adam, you got a challenge for next week?
No.
Don, do you have something reasonable?
Oh, I got one, but I already did it.
Oh. Can you do it again?
Holiday or Christmas card, something in the holiday spirit, and I already posted mine online, so I'm done.
Oh, then you got to do it again then, man. Seriously. I'll do Christmas card. No, let's do Christmas card.
Oh, it's too I was just joking.
No, we're doing Christmas card now.
Can I just resubmit mine?
Well, we'll know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Great. Yeah, no, I mean, that's it. That's it. We're doing Christmas card. Done.
Great.
Websites. Don, where can people find all your stuff?
Well, you can find me on any social media platform right now. You'll find a lot of my current Snowflake stuff, and you can see more of that at skycrystals.ca. For all the other fun work that I do, check out doncom.ca. And they're all linked to everywhere, so just remember those links, and I'm sure they'll be in the show notes as well, so you can just click through and find some of my most recent adventures.
We'll do. We're going to throw links on our site. Adam.
AdamSchwartz.ca, and maybe Two Hosers Facebook if I get around to posting anything.
Well, we're all on pins and needles.
Yeah, yeah.
You can check out my stuff at AlanAtridge.com or the two of us at TwoHosers.com, where you can find all the links we just talked about. Now, if anyone's still listening after the 4-hour episode, get out there and make better photos.